Harper Audio presents The Great Taos Bank Robbery, written and read by Tony Hillerman. The Great Taos Bank Robbery. The newsroom of the New Mexican first got word of the incident about 10 minutes after 9 the morning of November 12, 1957. Mrs. Ruth Fish, who had served for many years as manager of the Taos Chamber of Commerce and almost as many as Taos correspondent for the Santa Fe newspaper, called Collect and asked for the city editor. She told the city editor that the Taos Bank would be robbed that morning. She said she would walk over to the bank and watch the operation. She promised to call in an eyewitness account before the first edition deadline at 11 a.m. The city editor asked how Mrs. Fish knew the bank was to be robbed. Mrs. Fish, in a hurry to get off the telephone and become an eyewitness, explained very briefly that one of her lady friends had stopped in her office and told her so. The lady was now waiting so they could walk down together and watch. But, the city editor insisted, how did the lady friend know the bank was to be robbed that morning? Because, Mrs. Fish explained with patience, the two bank robbers were standing in line at this very moment, waiting their turn at the teller's cage. But, persisted the city editor, how was it possible to predict that those two persons intended to rob the bank? This presumption seems safe, Mrs. Fish said, because one of the two men was disguised as a woman and because he was holding a pistol under his purse, whereupon she said goodbye and hung up. While astonished by the foregoing, the city editor recalled later that he had no doubt at all that the bank would indeed be robbed in the fashion described. If the listener feels less sure at this point, it is because the city editor had two advantages. First, he knew Mrs. Fish, an elderly woman of dignity, charm, and grandmotherly appearance. She possessed a flawless reputation for accuracy. Second, he knew Taos. While bank robbers probably wouldn't stand politely in line with paying customers in Omaha or Atlanta, there was no reason to believe they wouldn't in this peculiar little town. As a matter of fact, they were doing exactly this, and their courtliness was about to cause him trouble. The chain of events that followed did not reach its semifinal anticlimax until 60 hours later and was not officially ended until the following March, when the federal grand jury met 65 miles south in Santa Fe. By then, the affair was being called the Great Taos Bank Robbery. Lest the listener be misled by this title, he should be warned that Taos also lists in its litany of notable events the Great Flood of 1935. If the listener can accept the fact that Taos managed a great flood without a river and with the very modest amount of water available in its arid climate, he is prepared to hear more about what happened on November 12, 1957. After the city editor collected his wits, he placed a long-distance call to the bank. The secretary who answered didn't know anything about a bank robbery, but she referred the call to a higher-ranking official. The city editor asked this gentleman if his bank had been robbed. "Certainly not," said the banker. "How in the world did such rumors get started?" A few minutes later, Mrs. Fish called back, slightly breathless. She reported that she and her friend had walked through the alley behind the Safeway store and arrived at the bank just as two men with drawn pistols dashed from the front door. One of the men was dressed as a woman, as previously reported. He ran awkwardly in his high heels. The two jumped into a green pickup truck parked in the alley and drove away. From what she had learned from spectators fortunate enough to arrive earlier, the two men had not taken any money from the bank. She would investigate further and call back. Mrs. Fish, a woman of impeccable courtesy, hung up without a word of reproach to the city editor for causing her to be late for this event. The city editor now placed another call to the banker. He asked the banker if he was sure his bank hadn't been robbed, or something. The bank official now was less confident. He was sure nobody had taken any money, but he was also sure that something funny had been going on. He had been hearing something about a man dressed as a woman and two men running wildly out of the bank lobby and other confusing stories. Meanwhile, a police reporter had called a Taos police department and said he was checking on a rumor that there had been a bank robbery. The policeman who answered said no, there hadn't been a bank robbery, and he guessed the police would be the first to hear about it if there had been one, wouldn't they? The reporter said yes, he guessed that was true. Actually, the police would be just about the last to hear about it, being informed only after the pastor of the local United Brethren Church entered the picture. By then, Mrs. Fish had made her third call and provided the city editor with a detailed account of what had happened in the bank lobby. The two men had arrived just as the bank opened its doors at 9 a.m. They found a crowd of Taos business people waiting to check out funds to fuel their cash registers for the day. The suspects joined a rush to the teller's cages, but were outdistanced, perhaps because of the high heels, and were stuck well back in the line. Customers quickly noticed that the line stander, clad as a woman, had a full day's growth of dark stubble bristling through his pancake makeup, and that the nylons encased an unseemly growth of leg hair. They also noticed that this person's costume was remarkably chic for Taos, which is one of the few places where a man can still feel adequately dressed downtown in bib overalls. All this was enough to cause a modest amount of buzzing in the lobby, but probably not much. Taos is a tolerant village, well accustomed to whimsy. It has been said that if the late James Thurber had been raised here, he would never have celebrated the antics of his family in print, since what seems outlandish in Columbus, Ohio, seems fairly normal in Taos. It is also said that if Sinclair Lewis had been a Taosano, Babbitt would have had a common-law wife and worn sandals. In Taos, a certain amount of eccentricity is required for conformity. Interest among the spectators quickened, however, when some of them saw, or thought they saw, a pistol in the hands of the pseudo-woman. The fleet-footed ones, who had beaten the rush to the teller's windows and therefore left early, spread the news of this unusual sight around Taos Plaza. Thus did Mrs. Fish receive the word, and thus were many curious town folks drawn to the bank to watch the spectacle. Several days later, one of the two suspects was to complain to federal agents that some among this growing crowd of spectators began giggling. Whether or not Taos residents were guilty of such churlishness, the two young men soon began suffering from stage fright. Embarrassed by the scrutiny of the crowd, they fled from the bank just as Mrs. Fish and her friend were arriving. It was definitely established, finally, that both men were armed with loaded pistols, although they were not to use these weapons until later, and then only when cruelly provoked. These revolvers are important because they lend an air of reality to the Great Taos Bank Robbery. It was much the same with the Great Flood of 1935. While it wasn't a flood in the usual definition, people actually did get wet. And Taosinos defend this historic event from scoffers by pointing out that Governor Clyde Tingley declared an emergency and scores of families were evacuated to the National Guard Armory. These facts seem persuasive unless one knows that this great flood was actually an epidemic of leaking roofs, the combined effect of a freakishly slow and persistent rain, and a traditional Taos habit of roofing flat-topped adobe buildings with hard-packed adobe clay. This roofing material is usually as effective as it is inexpensive, since Taos rainstorms are commonly brief, noisy, and productive of very little moisture. Taos learned in 1935 that when an eastern-style three-day drizzle happens, such economical roofs tend to dissolve and pour through the ceilings. Residents, Taos-like, still use dirt roofs and profited from the experience only by the legends of bravery, charity, and outrageous discomfort that it created. Today, Taosinos rely on the two loaded pistols to lend authenticity to their Great Taos Bank Robbery, just as they drag out the governor's unlocking of their armory when an outsider depreciates their flood. But before these pistols started going off, a couple of things had to happen. As Mrs. Fish reported, the two suspects roared away from the scene of their fiasco in a pickup truck. Their rush may have been prompted by the erroneous notion that someone would call the police, or perhaps by sheer embarrassment. Whatever the cause, The two ran a stop sign and sideswiped a car driven by the United Brethren minister. The minister was not in a mood that morning to turn the other fender. He insisted that the accident be reported to the police and that neither vehicle be moved until an officer arrived. The suspects took a dissenting position and insisted on driving away. The listener is aware that they had good reason for this rudeness, but the pastor at the moment was not. Neither could he know that the man in the pickup who wore lipstick and face powder had gotten himself up as a female for the relatively innocent purpose of misleading bank personnel. It is safe to guess that the minister suspected a darker purpose, since Taos has long been known as a place of confusion concerning gender. At any rate, when the two men drove away, the minister gave chase. Taos is a small community, and its streets are few, narrow, crooked, and short. It is a completely inappropriate setting for a high-speed automobile chase and offers limited opportunity for the chasee to elude the chaser. After two or three times around the village, the two suspects must have faced the fact that there was no hope of shaking off their pursuer. They began firing their pistol at the minister's car. Thus discouraged, the minister stopped at a telephone, and the police, at long last, learned that something was amiss in Taos. This seeming lack of rapport between Taos and the forces of authority would not surprise those familiar with the history of the village. The attitude of Taosenos had been largely responsible in 1847 for a joint proposal by Secretary of State Daniel Webster and Secretary of War C.M. Conrad that the United States withdraw from the territory of New Mexico and, quote, allow it to revert to its native inhabitants. The Webster-Conrad discouragement seems to have been due in large part to the fact that the townspeople of Taos, in a cooperative venture with the adjoining Taos Indian Pueblo, had scalped territorial Governor Charles Bent. The residence where this unique impeachment occurred is still maintained by the village in a museum that, one suspects, celebrates the deed more than the martyr. On another and later occasion, U.S. Attorney W.W.H. Davis reported with disapproving sarcasm that the door of the Taos jail was, quote, securely fastened with a twine string, and concluded that this lack of a bona fide lock might be why prisoners were so often missing when time came to try them. A person reading the Davis diary senses he might have had more to say on this subject had his attention not been diverted by conditions at the Pontius Pilate Hotel. Mr. Davis had called the attention of the innkeeper to the lack of coverings on his bed, and his host had corrected this deficiency by handing him the cloth from the dining table. Mr. Davis reported himself, quote, somewhat exercised of mind during the night with the question of how his host might supply the place of the tablecloth when morning came. When the sheet reappeared at the breakfast table, the U.S. attorney celebrated this ingenuity with a heroic couplet. Thus it contrived the double debt to pay, a sheet by night, a tablecloth by day. The Taos jail is now a modern building, but its walls that year were still made of adobe, which is vulnerable, as a prisoner named Danny Montoya had recently demonstrated, to plastic spoons. Montoya spooned a hole through the wall, but made two mistakes. First, he chose the wrong wall, digging his way into the county treasurer's office, which adjoins the lockup, instead of to freedom. Second, he underestimated his diameter, jammed himself into his exit route, and spent the night like a cork in a bottle, with his head still in custody. Aside from the jail, Taosenos' lack of interest in law enforcement can perhaps best be illustrated by an obituary article to which the Dawn of Liberty, a now-defunct Taos weekly newspaper, devoted two-thirds of its front page in 1953. The obituary reported the death of John Dunn, a very prominent Taos resident. It noted that Mr. Dunn had arrived at Taos after making his way from the Texas State Penitentiary without benefit of pardon or parole and with 39 years and 6 months left to serve on a 40-year sentence. It recounted Mr. Dunn's exploits as a dealer of two-card monte and as operator of gambling establishments at Taos and elsewhere in the county. Quote, John Dunn was at his best behind a roulette wheel or a Monte table, where you never got more than was coming to you, and if you didn't watch it, it was less. I have seen John Dunn stand for 10 hours at a roulette wheel and never look up, never asleep on the job, and never overlooking a chance to slip you a short stack of chips, the obituary writer reported. Gambling is not legal in New Mexico, nor, for that matter, is escaping from prison. Yet before John Dunn died in 1953, at the age of 94, he had lived 64 years in Taos, had been in the public eye enough to have the John Dunn Bridge bear his name, and had not been molested by the law. One can only assume that, as in the case of the Great Taos Bank robbery, police were slow in getting the word. Once the police were belatedly informed of the doings of November 12th at the bank and elsewhere, they reacted with vigor. A search began immediately for the two suspects. The state police were notified, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation was told of an apparent affront to the Federal Banking Act. By noon, the population of Taos, normally about 1,850, had been swollen by the influx of various types of officers. In addition to the genuine gendarmes representing federal, state, county, and village governments, volunteer organizations such as the Mounted Patrol and the Sheriff's Posse were mobilized. Authorities soon had the escape vehicle. It was driven into the midst of a swarm of lawmen by Jose T. Cardenas. Mr. Cardenas, when he collected himself from the shock of having guns pointed at him, explained that he had lent his truck to a friend the previous day, and that it had been left at his house that morning, bearing signs of collision damage. Mr. Cardenas was at that moment in search of this friend to demand an explanation. The listener might well pause here and recollect that it is traditional among robbers to steal escape vehicles, not to borrow them from friends. Borrowing, while more polite, leads to speedy identification when the car is recovered. Mr. Cardenas was able to tell police that he had loaned his truck to a man I shall call Joe Gomez, a 33-year-old Taos native, and that Mr. Gomez was accompanied by Frederick Smith, a 23-year-old resident of Maine who had been visiting in the village. Police also quickly received a hint of why the two had borrowed the truck a day early. Witnesses were found who had seen them at the entrance of the bank the previous morning, the morning of November 11th. The witnesses remembered this because they thought it odd to see a man dressed as a woman trying to get into the bank on Veterans Day. If any doubts remained on the subject, this should have proved that the two were not professional bank robbers, since professionals presumably would know about national bank holidays. At this point, the authorities appeared to be in a happy position. They knew the identities of both men, they thought. They had an excellent description of the suspect. They were confident both were afoot in Taos. The village is small. The lawmen were numerous. And there was every reason for confidence that the two culprits would be in custody in a very few minutes. The officers fanned out from the plaza to press their search. This proved to be a mistake because Gomez and Smith had decided to walk down to the plaza to try to borrow some money. While the federal, state, county, and city officers and their volunteer posses manned roadblocks and poked around in the outlying areas, the two fugitives were making a door-to-door canvas of downtown bars, soliciting loans from the bartenders. Not unnaturally, the bartenders considered the two poor credit risks at this moment. By the time it occurred to someone to inform the law of this activity, Gomez and Smith had become discouraged and wandered off. By the time the sun dropped behind the Conejos Mountains, the lawman had found Gomez's female attire abandoned in an outdoor toilet. But the fugitives were still at large. The hunt continued through the night, brightening the frosty November darkness with flashlights and electric lanterns. Considering the number of officers involved and the modest dimensions of Taos, it is safe to guess that at least one policeman looked almost everywhere at least once, except in a deserted house where the two had chosen to sleep. When the sun rose over the Taos Mountains the morning of November 13th, Gomez and Smith were still at large. There was some talk now of sending for Sam, the New Mexico bloodhound, but the motion apparently died for lack of a second. Perhaps this was because the only time Sam had been used in Taos County in the past, he immediately became disoriented, strayed, and was lost for 2 days. November 13th passed with a methodical and fruitless combing of the village. There was a brief flurry of excitement when the officers learned in some roundabout manner that Gomez and Smith had again appeared on the plaza, renewing their futile attempts to float alone. Police now discovered, 12 hours too late to do them any good, where Gomez and Smith had spent the previous night. They discovered that a neighborhood householder had happened by their hideout, had seen the fugitives, had stopped to chat with them about the excitement they had caused, and had then left to buy them some groceries. The listener by now will not be surprised to know that this good neighbor did not bother to notify the police. But he did play a little joke on the culprits when he returned with the food, telling them that they had critically wounded the minister and that officers had orders to get them dead or alive. This unnerving bit of misinformation drove the two to make their second return to the plaza and renew their attempt to borrow traveling money. While one can imagine that their pleas were eloquent, the bartenders remained adamant. Gomez told a reporter 2 days later that by now he and Smith were, quote, feeling mighty blue. If the fugitives were depressed by November 13th, it is reasonable to bet that those involved in the search for them shared this feeling. Taos does not lend itself to extended manhunts. The posse members soon run out of places to look. To make matters worse, the press had taken the whole affair lightly from the first, and newspaper irreverence increased as the search dragged on. When November 14th wore on without a sign of the fugitives, those in charge of the hunt must have been casting about for a dignified excuse to call off the whole affair. Their ordeal, however, was almost over. That night, a Taos resident named Nat Flores was lying on his bed reading the evening paper when he heard a tapping on his window. Outside, he saw two young men whom he recognized as Gomez and Smith. The two inquired if he might provide them with a meal, and Flores, with typical, "my house is your house," Taos hospitality, invited his visitors in for supper. During the meal, Flores and Jovi Montoya, a brother-in-law who had stopped in for a chat, found Gomez and Smith in a gloomy mood. The two said they had spent the previous night in frostbitten discomfort in Kit Carson Park, a small recreation area not far from Taos Plaza. One of the possemen, Smith complained, had almost stepped on his finger. Flores and Montoya, after a lengthy argument in which Flores recalled quoting passages from the Bible, persuaded the two that they should accept a ride down to the sheriff's office after supper and turn themselves in. The final footnote on the Great Taos Bank Robbery was not written until February 4, 1958. After the surrender, officers found the two refreshingly frank about their activities. In due course, Joe Gomez and Frederick Smith were accused by the U.S. attorney of conspiring to violate provisions of the Federal Banking Act, and their case was placed on a winter docket for consideration by the federal grand jury. Unfortunately, grand jury proceedings are secret, so we will never know exactly what happened when the case was presented. We do know that the jury returned a no bill, which indicates, at very least, that the jurors could not be convinced that Gomez and Smith took their pistols into the Taos Bank with felonious intentions. If the jurors were not familiar with Taos, they may have suspected that the FBI imagined a whole unlikely episode. Thus, the Great Taos Bank Robbery was denied the official federal imprimatur of indictments and was left as the sort of thing Alice's Mad Hatter might call an unfelonious unrobbery. Still, if you happen to be in Taos on Veterans Day, and the man on the next bar stool happens to be an old Taos hand, you're likely to hear something like this. "You know, tomorrow is the anniversary of our big bank robbery." Or maybe he'll tell you about the Great Flood of 1935. The Navajo who had so many friends he couldn't get no wire strung. The young matron who went to Barnard College and read books, is explaining to the Valencia County wool grower and to me about Navajo mythology. Snake was one of the holy people who came to the earth's surface world with first man and first woman, she tells us, which is why Navajos won't kill snakes. Valencia County wool grower stops poking at the olive in his martini and says, "One time I got old man Madman to get some of his son-in-laws to build some fence for me over there by Redondo Mesa. I warned him about all those rattlesnakes out there in the Malpai, and he says, 'That's all right, snakes are friends of the Navajo.' So the next day I haul some wire out there, and there's dead snakes laying all over that lava rock. So I says, 'Hosteen Madman, how come you told me rattlesnakes and Navajos are friends?' And he kind of grins, and he says, 'We friends, but we had so goddamn many friends around here we couldn't get no wire strung.'" The very heart of our country. We are standing, Alex Atcity and I, on a slope under the great rampart of red rock which runs like a Chinese wall along the south end of Navajo country. To the east, Mount Taylor rises snow-capped and serene above the blunt shape of Little Haystack Mountain. To the left, eroded sandstone, broken slate, a half-dead pinon whose branches collect tumbleweeds from the gusty wind. It is November of a year of almost unbroken drought. The air smells of autumn, pine resin, dust, and empty places. The only living things inside are a sparrowhawk and a disconsolate Hereford. The hawk is scouting the rim of the Red Mesa for incautious rodents. The cow, resting from its search for something to eat, is staring moodily in the direction of Gallup. "You know," Atcity says, "they gave us our choice. A bunch of rich Arkansas River bottomland over in Oklahoma, or this." He waves his arm, including erosion, dead brush, cow, and an infinity of gaudy sunset sky in the gesture, and grins at me. "When you understand why we picked this rock pile instead of that $1,000 an acre cotton land, then you understand Navajos." The Navajos made this historic choice on May 28, 1868. It had been offered the day before by General William Tecumseh Sherman to Barboncita, Manuelita, Ganado Mucho, and other clan leaders. In return for their pledge never again to bear arms, the U.S. government would give them a choice of reservations. They could remain at Fort Sumner, where most of them had been unhappily penned since 1864, or the government would transport them to a well-watered, well-timbered, game-rich reservation in the Arkansas River Valley of Indian Territory. There was a third alternative. They could return to that arid expanse of canyons and mesas from which the Army had starved them by a 3-year campaign of hogan burning, cattle killing, and general earth scorching. In his report to President Andrew Johnson, General Sherman made it clear that the land involved in his third choice was worthless. It was, as Sherman put it, as far from our future possible wants as was possible to discover. Worthless or not, the Navajo choice was to go home. "If we are taken back to our own country," Barboncita told Sherman, "we will call you our father and mother. If there was only a single goat there, we would all live off of it." Barboncita was a warrior, not an orator, but listen to his words. "I hope to God you will not ask us to go to any country but our own. When the Navajos were first created, 4 mountains and 4 rivers were pointed out to us, inside of which we should live, and that was to be Dinita. Changing Woman gave us this land. Our God created it specially for us." The tribe voted unanimously the next day to return to Dinita, a reservation including part of San Juan Valley and the Chuska and Carrizosa Mountains was drawn. It was far less than the Navajos had occupied before 1864 and included none of the four sacred mountains which hold their world together. But Barboncito was pleased. "It is the very heart of our country," he said. One of those four mountains is Mount Taylor. Manuelito recalled that when the Navajos topped the ridge west of the Rio Grande on their famous long walk home, they saw its peak outlined against the western horizon. He said his men, hard-bitten survivors of 3 years of desperate, hopeless combat, wept for joy. "This is Sozil, the turquoise mountain. Here rests the head of the great Ye, whose spirit body circles across Mount Blanco in the Sangre de Cristos and Mount Hesperus in the La Platas to the San Francisco peaks above Flagstaff, encircling the Dinita with harmony. The great spirit called First Man built this mountain with earth brought from the third world. He decorated it with turquoise, blue cloud, and female rain, pinned it to the earth with a magic knife, and left Tlisso, Big Snake, to guard it. It was here the Hero Twins opened their campaign to make Dinita safe for the people by killing the first of the monsters. The blood of one walking giant forms the great lava flows across which Interstate 40 cuts a 5-mile swath east of Grant. And here Turquoise Girl lives, forever guarding the heart of Barboncita's country. Much of this original Dinita can be seen on an easy drive up New Mexico 44 to the Farmington Shiprock area, and then down U.S. 666 to Gallup, which is, in fact as well as claim, the Indian capital of the United States. With a few appropriate side trips, this route will take you through the Holy Land of the Navajo religion. And if the light is right, the cloud formation suitably dramatic, the sunsets as flamboyant as usual, you may glimpse why the Navajos chose to keep this arid land Changing Woman gave to them, and why Alex Atcity left a good job in Los Angeles to come home. Navajos arrived in Dinita not much later than A.D. 1000. They were hunters and seed gatherers. They spoke an Athabascan language, as do their cousins the Apaches and many tribes of western Canada. I'm told that Navajos who listened to a tape recording made of a carrier Indian in Canada could understand nearly every word. Anthropologists believe they drifted in from the north in small clan groups. Navajo mythology is more specific. The holy people climbed into Dinita from an underworld, emerging from the flooding third world through a hollow reed. These holy people included First Man and First Woman, and most of the insect, bird, and animal people. The exact point of emergence is as hard to locate as the Garden of Eden. However, we know that First Man lived at Huerfano Mesa, and that he found the infant Changing Woman crying on top of Gobernador Knob, less than 30 miles across the Rio Riba County border. In this same area, Black God helped First Man and First Woman hang the stars in the sky. Coyote, always mischievous, flipped a star-filled storage blanket and created the Milky Way. It was near here that Changing Woman created the first human Navajos out of fragments of skin rubbed from her body. Atcity's clan, the Bitterwater, was formed from her right armpit. And it was here that most of the great poetic curing and blessing ceremonials of the people seemed to have taken form. As you drive up New Mexico 44, with Ngezi Trading Post behind you and Bloomfield 20 miles ahead, you pass Huerfano Mesa on your right. As the Spanish name suggests, Huerfano means orphan or alone. It is all by itself, a huge rectangular monolith of stone that rises to 7,470 feet out of the chemisa and sage expanse of the Blanco Plateau. The oil companies that lined the rim of this sacred mesa with 17 radio broadcasting towers have also built roads, providing easy access to the spectacular scenery of Blanco Canyon. and just 8 miles beyond where Fano is the entry to the Angel Peak Recreational Area, where the sun, slanting against several hundred million years of fantastic multicolored erosion, creates memorable beauty. The holy people call this the glittering world. Standing on the overlook at Angel Peak, one sees why. The northeastern landmark of Dinita is Shiprock, reached through Farmington, the San Juan Valley, and the town of Shiprock. The town is a major administrative center for this part of the reservation, and, as Huerfano represents the Navajo past, it represents the tribal future. Here, in the 1960s, was a mini-boom of look-alike public housing, the pick-up crowded parking lots of Fairchild Semiconductor, the bustle of the oil and gas industry, the beginnings of a tourist business. On the mesa above Fruitland to the east loomed the controversial Four Corners power plant, producing clouds of smoke and being fed by the Navajo coal mine, already the world's largest. Here soon would be the 110,000-acre Navajo irrigation project. And here El Paso Natural was asking the Interior Department for permission to open a $400 million operation to convert coal into gas. 40,000 acres with an estimated yield of 700 million tons of coal are under lease. Whatever position you take on the air pollution controversy, the power complex is worth seeing. The entry road climbs less than a mile out of the lush irrigation of the Fruitland into a surreal world. The mine, tied to the plant with broad paved coal roads, beggars description. Its mountainous waste piles stretch 10 miles, so incredibly huge that in a landscape of grotesque exaggerations, they almost manage to look natural. The power plant, too, is vast enough to overpower a less dramatic setting. But behind it, across the blue water of Morgan Lake, looms a great mottled hump of Hogback Mountain and the cathedral spire of Shiprock 20 miles away, blue against a brewing snowstorm. The man-made plant is properly dwarfed. From as far south as Gray Mountain, as far north as Colorado, and as far west as Yazzie in the Arizona Lucachicay Mountains, Shiprock juts like a great thumb into the sky. It's a strange formation, the plaster cast of the inside of a volcano. The volcano cone has been worn away by millions of years of wind and rain, leaving only the tough igneous rock which once bubbled and boiled in its throat. This core towers 1,450 vertical feet above the grassy plain, 20 stories taller than the Empire State Building. Shiprock is hard to describe. One remembers how it looked the last time he saw it, and how it looked in the 100 photographs he has seen. But when he approaches it again, this time on a November afternoon with a snow squall sliding down the sky out of Utah, he finds that both memory and pictures have lied. Under the sun and against the blue desert sky, Shiprock had provided a foreboding contrast, its ragged bulk suggesting the cataclysmic violence of its birth. But against this day's stormy, troubled cloudscape, it soars timeless and serene, proof against the violence of the sky. One way to reach it is via Navajo Route 13, which leaves U.S. 666 7 miles south of Shiprock Town and ambles 45 miles westward through Buffalo Pass. The bad old gravel road has been replaced now with asphalt, and it's a pleasant drive. From the highway junction, the angle of vision merges Roll Hay Rock and Table Mesa, 6 miles south, into a single shape. It suggests the ultimate aircraft carrier, 20 stories tall and 3 miles long, anchored in a sea of grama grass. 8 miles from 666, the Navajo route passes through a break in the most dramatic of the volcanic walls that radiate from Shiprock. I find this wall hard to believe. The wall probably formed during the great neogenic volcanic period, which thrust Mount Taylor, 11,390 feet into the sky, caused a mind-boggling Valle Grande explosion, and scattered ashes from Utah to Kansas. The stone crust of the earth cracked open here. From the base of Shiprock Volcano, cracks radiate outward, miles long but only 3 or 4 feet wide. Red-hot plastic rock squeezed up through these cracks and through the heavy ash above, like toothpaste from a tube. On this day, perhaps 15 million years later, only a sloping buttress of earth remains of the ash. The Great Wall stands exposed. It is snowing now on Beautiful Mountain, 10 miles to the southwest, and the breeze is gusty, cool, and damp. In places, holes have been eroded through the wall, and through these holes the breeze funnels and becomes wind enough to set up a muted howling. The wall wanders almost due north toward Shiprock, and from the buttress of earth, the immensity of this monolith makes it seem only a few hundred yards away. It is actually almost 4 miles, and as one walks along the wall, alone, dwarfed, with the west wind playing it like a grotesque stone flute, it is easier to buy the Navajo view of man as part of nature than the white man's view of himself as master of it. Shiprock is rarely visited. The old tracks following the wall are almost erased. Once one walks a few hundred yards from the road, the only clue that others share this planet is a corpse of a car abandoned here years ago. West of the wall, a mile or so away, is the homestead of a Navajo family. Small house, sheds, corrals, and hogan. The Navajo cooperates with the mystique of this place by using his grazing permit to raise horses. They range on the landscape below, a mixed bag of colors and types, with enough pintos and paints included to satisfy a movie casting director. In mythic times, the Navajo would not have been safe here. Say Ninahile, the winged monster, nested in the cliffs of this rock with wings. Like other monsters inhabiting the glittering world, it ate people. But somewhere north of Huerfano, Changing Woman had slept beside a waterfall and had become pregnant and had borne twin sons, and their names were Monster Slayer and Child Born of Water. Their father was the errant sun, and around those twins, Navajo mythology is woven an odyssey which rivals the tales of Homer. Monster Slayer tricked Winged Monster into dropping him into the nest atop Shiprock. There he killed the beast. He persuaded the monster's offspring to forswear monsterhood and become instead the eagle and the owl. Then he persuaded Spider Woman to rescue him from this impossible perch by lowering him in a basket. Tribal mythology also credits Spider Woman with teaching the Navajos to weave, a craft which the people have made an art. And while the myths assign no particular home to this holy person, a logical place would be Two Gray Hills, the site of the finest flowering of her teaching. One reaches this old trading post by turning off U.S. 666 at Newcomb Junction, 30 miles south of Shiprock. The dirt road goes 12 miles westward to Todlina Boarding School in the Chuska Mountains. Halfway there, looking exactly the way a trading post should look, is Two Gray Hills. The road winds out of a wash, and here to your right front are a barn with attached cattle and sheep pens, and a long, low building with a single gasoline pump and a line of pickup trucks in front.